few years ago, I traveled to Senegal with my family. We were visiting some old friends working in the Lutheran church there. And my younger son, Finn, loves animals. He works for the Humane Society now. He has dogs and rats and chickens, and he'd have a horse if he could. And he was also a young teen at the time, at that stage where like the whole world is either like right or wrong, super clear. And it was the beginning of him becoming a vegetarian and then a vegan, protesting against the treatment of animals. So we were anticipating a really different kind of experience of animals in Dakar, Senegal. And so we sat down with Finn and we said, like, you know, you go out to your horse farm and you go horseback riding and it's for your enjoyment. And you have a little puppy that snuggles up beside you on the couch. And that's awesome. And we're going to see more animals who are work animals in Senegal. They're not treated like pets like you're used to. And sure enough, he was like super offended and judgmental and upset about how the horses were treated that pulled the carts and wagons through the car. And the drivers used crops to urge their horses onward. And it became Finn's obsession on this trip to look for and feel concerned about all the horses. But it was interesting, by the end of the trip, he started to reset his vision a little bit to see a different kind of care and concern for animals. He got windows on how people cared for their animals there, like washing them down after a hard day or giving them a bucket of food. And toward the end of our trip, he even got to ride on a horse car to meet the horses in Linguère, which is up in the northeast of the country. I also had a love of animals growing up. I had a horse named Lemonade, and we always had animals at our place. But for me, as for Finn, like, the riding was for fun. Lemonade didn't do any work to speak of. Like, we would just go riding. We had 5 acres. We had a big garden, and we usually had a cow or a sheep that we were fattening up to use for meat over the winter. And I was just thinking, you know, it wasn't that long ago in our country when animals were primarily work animals, like we experienced in Senegal. I was thinking about my dad growing up on a ranch in Wyoming. He had a horse named Smokey. And Smokey was used for hunting and for going and rounding up animals. It was a fun thing for him, but it was a workhorse. And when he was young, they didn't have a tractor. They plowed the fields with their horses. And they had lots of animals. All the animals played a role in their, like, subsistence. It was small ranch subsistence lifestyle. And the animals that they had were not only important for them, but, like, for the whole, we have multiple animals on screen at the moment. The animals weren't just important to their family, but they were a shared resource in the community. Like, they would share draft horses for plowing during the spring or for harvest during the fall. When my dad was growing up, about 60% of Americans lived in rural areas and about 40% worked on farms. And today, it's pretty stark. Only 20% of the population of the U.S. lives in a rural area and only 1% live and work on farms. And farms are on average at least double the size of what they were 100 years ago. Many much bigger, supersized farms with corporate ownership and farm workers, immigrant farm workers who are doing the labor. And whereas my family might have done the harvest with a team of horses, now the farmers use a John Deere combine tractor that costs like $500,000 to buy. So industrialization has happened in agriculture, as in many other places in the economy. And I was thinking about, like, what happened with that change, not only in agriculture, but across the economy. And it strikes me that, like, there was an exchange of technology for greater efficiency and greater profit. And there are lots of consequences from that exchange. a friend and colleague of mine, who's an ethicist, Larry Rasmussen, describes what he thinks the root exchange is, which is the disenchantment of the world. Like, we gave up the value of creatures and things as important in themselves so that we could monetize their value, so we could speak of the material world and other people as resources. So when you add that, and then on top of it, the oppressive gender and race and class and species hierarchies that we have, then whole classes of people and creatures are just made into resources available to be exploited. So one might say that the trade we made for industrialization has in the end potentially traded short-term wealth for long-term unsustainability of life as we know it on this planet. Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, ends with him saying, the final lynching of the white domination system is going to be the lynching of the earth. So I'm conscious of these dramatic changes that we've gone through and how we regard each other and creatures and the earth on this Labor Day that we're honoring this weekend. And I just want to recall its origins for a minute, that it was started in the late 1800s by President Grover Cleveland to appease the labor movement. But he, instead of putting it on May Day, which is what they wanted, which he felt would be more radical, more dangerous, he put it at the beginning of September. And that fight that was going on at the time in the late 1800s was for an 8-hour workday. That's what they were organizing around. And that, in a sense, is the root of this holiday, like the deep goal of the labor movement and of Labor Day as a day to honor that is the goal of reversing the exchange that was made in industrialization, like a re-enchantment of the world that calls us to, again, value creatures and things as holy and valuable in and of themselves, not simply because of their productive potential. I think their efforts that are behind this holiday embody one of my favorite dictums from, or aphorisms from, Karl Marx, which is, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. So this little verse from Deuteronomy has a surprising history in the Christian tradition around how we think about work and labor. And I want to just unpack that as we turn the corner to engage the text. First of all, for those of you who are like agriculturally slightly distant, just name what threshing is. Threshing is when like wheat or grain is all dry and you harvest it, then you lay it out on a threshing floor, and they will have the ox drag like a big piece of wood over it, and it crushes the plant and knocks out the grain so that you can separate the dried plant from the grain and gather together the kernel. Obviously, we use big combines to do that now, but that's the traditional method for doing it that this text is talking about. So why does this passage play a role in Christian reflection on labor? That's interesting. It's because St. Paul, in his letters, quotes this verse on two different occasions, in 1 Corinthians and in 1 Timothy. And Paul basically uses the text in an analogical sense to support his own case that he should get paid. This is what he writes in 1 Corinthians. For it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is threshing out the grain. Is it about the oxen? Paul goes on. Is it about the oxen that God is concerned? Surely God is saying this for us, right? Yes, this was written for us, because whoever plows and threshes should be able to do so in the hope of sharing in the harvest. So I think Paul misuses this verse by saying it's not about the ox. I think it's exactly about the ox. Given agricultural realities of the day, there's a number of possibilities that could have been the case, but this is the one that makes the most sense of this scenario, that a person had some land, but the person wasn't wealthy enough to own an ox. So the farmer borrows or rents an ox to thresh the grain. If the farmer only thinking selfishly about maximizing yield, then muzzling the ox to prevent it from eating makes some sense. But the communal neighbor-loving ethic of Judaism doesn't allow this. Moses commands that the ox do its work unmuzzled so it can dip its head down occasionally to munch on the grain, giving it energy for the work and returning it to its owner healthy and well, rather than depleted. It's an open-handed action that sees God as the giver of the grain, the giver of the oxen, the giver of the neighbor from whom it is borrowed. So the farmer's good work for themselves in the circle of land and neighbors is an honoring of this law. It actually recalls other laws very similar to this, like the law of the Sabbath earlier in Deuteronomy chapter 5. 6 days you shall labor and do your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall do no work, neither you nor your son nor daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your town. Everybody and everything gets to rest. So I didn't get a full signal out to everyone about a dinner prompt, but my dinner prompt to my dinner group was to just reflect on when have you felt really seen and humanized and sort of been respected in an experience of a workplace, a feeling of like being really generative and life-giving in a workplace. And I want to close by circling around to where I began, which is, I think Finn is right. I think my kiddo is right. We won't survive without caring for all of life, without re-enchanting our world so that harm to another, harm to the earth, actually harms ourselves. I give thanks to God for labor movements that gave us Labor Day, for the social change and justice their protests brought. And I feel its deep moral logic echoed in our faith tradition that calls us to care not for ourselves alone, but for neighbor, for creature, for planet.